it's going to be crazy town. That's the world I live in already. So I'm now just jealous that I could have been running agents in the background 24/7.
You missed this golden window of opportunity where people were literally just taking money out of, you know, Dario's pocket, basically.
That could have been me.
That could have been me. You could have been a big star, Chris. All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of the smartest and wittiest voices in technology to explain, debate, and analyze our way through the truly overwhelming wave of news each week in artificial intelligence. Today, I'm joined by a stellar crew, Chris Hay, Distinguished Engineer and CTO of Customer Transformation, Kautar El Megrawi, Principal Research Scientist and Manager for Hybrid Cloud Platform. And joining us for the very first time is Bruno Aziza, Vice President, Data, AI, and Analytics Strategy. We have a packed episode today, and in fact, we're going to be publishing early given all the news that's just come in, I think, in like literally the last 72 hours. We're going to talk about Genie 3, Claude code rate limiting, and Zuck getting on the superintelligence train. But first, let's talk about the big news of the week, which is GPT-OSS. So let's get into GPT-OSS. I really want to bring up this topic because I think this is like one of the things, a little bit like GPT-5, where I think it's been rumored that OpenAI has been working on this for months and months and months, and it is finally here. The quick recap of the news is that they've released two open source models, a 120B model and a 20B model. And I think just to do our usual quick round the horn question, you know, I think the one that I want to get from all the panelists is basically how big of a trend is this? And the question is, in the next 5 years, will OpenAI be transitioned fully into being an open source play versus a proprietary model play? Kautar, what do you think?
Maybe. I think because OpenAI is walking this tightrope between competitive pressure to open up and also ethical responsibility to keep up with, you know, these dangerous capabilities contained.
That's a good thought. Bruno, predictions for 2030. Is OpenAI fully open source at that point?
Well, first, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be part of this crew. Second, it's really hard to predict the future. So I'm not going to take a chance on that. But what I will say, though, is I think it's indicative of a trend here in this market where OpenAI, I think, is seeing the opportunity to do something a little different and probably get access to enterprise issues that we deal with. And so I think overall for the industry, it's a great move.
Great. And Chris, finally, what do you think?
No.
Okay. So we've got a real difference of opinion here. I mean, Chris, as usual, being our little spoiler on it. Chris, do you want to put forward the argument like this open source thing? I don't know. Some people have been saying like this is just marketing for them. I don't know if you agree with that take.
I don't think it's just marketing. I think the open white models are really, really important. And I love GPT-OSS. They have done a fantastic job. So I expect them to continue on that trend. I hope they continue on that trend. But will they go fully open source by 2030? I doubt it, because they're going to want to keep the big models to themselves. And they want to keep their competitive advantage and they want to be able to make money. But I applaud the move.
Kautar, this is a little bit of a dangerous move, right? I mean, I think to Chris's point, right? Like ultimately OpenAI needs to make money. and it sure feels like releasing these very, very performant OSS models, it does really kind of compete with their core product, right? Like aren't some of their customers going to just adopt OpenAI open source rather than having to pay them? How sustainable do you think this sort of thing is?
I think maybe they were pressured to do these things because if OpenAI stops short here with no access to training data, architectural design, or ecosystem level tooling, so they may win, you know, the short term market share. But I think long term influence in this global AI, you know, competing world, where these competing open models and governance-backed open initiatives are already filling that void. So it is, you know, I think an issue with the competition, because we're already seeing like Mistral and, you know, Meta, and, you know, their models are also doing very well. So if they keep everything closed, they might, you know, lose that competitive edge. But again, here, they don't give access to the training data, the ecosystem level. And I think providing the open weights is very important, you know, because they can also get, you know, that researchers, you know, to play with their models and fine tune. And so that is, I think, an important play for them to have. They will continue on that. Well, whether they will become fully open source eventually, I kind of agree with Chris, maybe not fully open source. They might maybe have a adopt a hybrid strategy because of this competitive pressure. Because if the US firms don't open up completely DeepSeek and Chinese alternatives, they can dominate the OpenAI ecosystem, not technologically, but also culturally. So there is, you know, this legitimacy pressure that is kind of pushing them to open source some of their models. And the open weight is a great initiative, I think.
Yeah, Bruno, I see you nodding. Do you want to
jump
in?
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to provide a little bit of a maybe a different perspective on this because, you know, I spend a lot of time with customers and I think the future is hybrid, right? There's not going to be one model to rule it all. There's not going to be one deployment model. And often we have to make these choices, one or the other. I think the enterprise is going to get both. And I think the reason for why it's, in a way, it could be interpreted as a good move from OpenAI, at least for the customers. One is they have to do this offensively, right? I think you've got a lot of consumers that are familiar with the model and they're using it all day long, kind of like what we started using the iPhone. And now they have the opportunity of, well, now you could be in the enterprise. You can use that model for yourself. And so I think it's a great way for them to lean on familiarity of consumers using their model and also now starting to, so I think that's one. Second one, I think, is what you're saying is defensively. I think if they don't do this, there's a lot of competition in this space and they might lose the what could be, in fact, a very profitable market in the enterprise. Today, I mean, doing this for the consumers, I think, as everyone knows, is a fairly expensive game. And so I think they ought to do it for their business to diversify their approach and really focus on what we know the future is, which is not just cloud. It is not just closed. It is hybrid and it's hybrid forever.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that defensive point I think is worth pushing on. I mean, you know, Chris, I think it's a really interesting development. I did want to talk a little bit about kind of like the branding in some sense of these models. What I hear is that, you know, like you're going to be able to get like GPT OSS on Watson X pretty soon, right? Which is like pretty different from like, I think the way I was thinking about this market evolving, which is we're going to see a little bit like more of what happened in mobile, right? Where, you know, OpenAI was going to be the Apple, they even hired Joni Ive, right? Like the Apple of AI, where everything is going to be vertically integrated. You can only touch their models through their infrastructure. Seems like, I mean, that wall has fallen. It seems like we're not moving towards Apple world in the market for AI. Is that a good way of thinking about it?
I don't know. I mean, the way I like to think about this one is these models are very specific to consumer grade hardware, right? They have been specifically designed for that. So if we take the 20 billion parameter model, it's designed to run on a machine with 16 gig of memory and a single GPU. And then, you know, and they've even quantized it down to that level. So, and then for even the 120 billion parameter model, that's designed to run on a single H100 card so you can go and fine tune that and not hit across multiple cards. And it's actually even designed to run on a high-end MacBook Pro. I'm running that on my machine at home, not my IBM issued machine, but my personal one. You know,
to be clear,
take that how you want, IBM. So it is designed specifically, and they've had to make trade-offs as well. So if we look at the model there, you can see it's a text-only model. It's not it's not a multimodal model in that sense. It is specific to the English language, and it is focused on code, and it's focused on agents, as you can imagine. So it's hugely sort of designed, one, to be fast, but it's also designed for tool calling in that sense. It gives away a lot. It's a reasoning model, which again is a great move because that gives away a lot of their architecture that they're running in the back end there. So I think it is very, very, and actually the fact is it's a mixture of experts model where we get to see the amount of experts that they have, and it's that. And the active experts is actually tiny. The number of parameters that are active at any point is really tiny, which gives you such fast speed. So this is a model that's specifically designed for consumer-grade hardware and edge devices, etc. You know, so it's designed for us usage. And now if we compare that to the back-end models that they're running, they're multimodal, they're going to be much larger, they're going to span across multiple H100s, you know, they're going to be multi-language, that they're going to have a lot more data put in there as well. So I don't think these models that run on our machine are going to be competitive with their back-end systems. Now, it's great that they have equivalents to the kind of the O3 and O4 minis, which is great. But again, I think they're not giving away a lot in that sense. So we get to feel good. We're going to be able to go and build agentic systems. You're going to build up great brand affinity with OpenAI. And then, but ultimately, you're probably going to still be using some of the large models on the back-end system. Now, so I think it's a great move, and I absolutely applaud that you can run out on other people's platforms as well. So, and I think that's gonna come through. So, yeah, I'm excited.
And if you look at the enterprise usage patterns, you're now going to get a lot of people that have been experimenting with the models, the OpenAI models, that now can take this home or in their own environment and actually optimize for costs in their own environment. So I actually think for customers, there's a lot of upside to this.
Definitely, I agree. Yes, basically, I think it is a very strategic move. I agree with what Bruno and Chris said, because they're facing, you know, this increasing competition from the powerful open source models. So when they release these things, they can first recapture goodwill from the open source community. Second, compete directly with these other open source players. And third, drive adoption for their technology on a wider scale, like Chris and also Bruno mentioned, especially in enterprises that have these strict data privacy and security requirements and need on-premise solutions. And it's still going to be on OpenAI rails. So it's really important for them to, you know, continue to that adoption. And I think it's also around also framing the narrative around democratic AI, especially enforcing U.S. leadership in the field, which is a politically savvy, you know, move here, because we don't want all the open source models to come from other countries. So I think they're trying also to reinforce the U.S. leadership here. So this open way distinction, I think, is crucial because OpenAI is still trying to maintain a level of control and competitive advantages with their proprietary models like GPT-4. While still trying to reap the benefits of a more open approach. So it's like have your cake and eat it too strategy.
Yeah, we're going to have to see whether or not they can walk this tightrope. It's going to be very, very interesting to see. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Really wanted to cover this very, very interesting thing that just popped up, I think just earlier this week. So DeepMind launched a blog post describing its latest edition of an open world generative model they call Genie 3. And I super encourage you to go online, look it up. I could describe it, but words are not going to do a good job describing it. I'm going to attempt to anyways to set up the discussion. The Genie kind of generation of models that DeepMind has been working on, I think for me is like a truly magical demo, where the idea is you sort of describe what you want. And then it basically creates like an immersive 3D world that you can sort of walk around in, navigate in on demand, basically, which is, I mean, as someone who played a lot of video games growing up, is a truly wild idea that like you can basically just say, I would like this kind of virtual environment, and that virtual environment just appears out of the other side. Bruno, maybe I'll toss it to you. I mean, this is like a very impressive demo. Why is this important from like a research standpoint? Is this kind of just like a toy, or should we actually be more focused on this for more reasons than, you know, it's a really cool
deal.
Demo?
It's a big deal. I'll admit I'm a little biased, of course, because I just joined from Google. So I do experiment with a lot of the Google technology. And I think this move to immersive, regenerative models for video like this, I think is a big deal. It's a big deal on a few dimensions. I think one, in the way that we experience information. I don't know about you all, but I use Notebook LM to prepare for some of my conversations. And so, and Notebook LM is going to get video mode. When I present information, and just did a presentation this weekend for one of my kids, I used a video model from Google inside slides in order to communicate. So the way we get influence and in how we consume and communicate, I think is huge. Now, this model, I guess, is not available yet, is a little bit different, right? It's when it's available, I guess we get to all play with it, but it's not a typical LM, right? So, and it's going to have an impact, not just on how we communicate, consume, but how you think about the experience in movies and games, and you can change on the spot what the experience is going to be. And so I can't wait to see what people are going to do with it, because I think beyond just the consumer aspect of it, I also see our ability to communicate more effectively and experience different things. And I think it's not going to take very long before it changes the way we think about information.
Bruno, if you are using PowerPoint to communicate with your kids, then IBM is the right company for you. welcome aboard.
I try to influence them any way I can, you know, so...
Yeah,
when words are limited and language is inefficient, I got to use images and videos.
That's right.
I mean, I imagine it's like, puppy, please say after me, puppy, next slide. Dog.
Right, as you see on the next slide. I think this is like a question that I had is, and this is, I think, a discussion that's been playing out in the video gen space as well, which is like, is there a consumer market for video gen, right? Like, ultimately, I could see, right, Bruno, you know, game designers using this and, you know, VR designers using this. But it's like, on a day-to-day basis, do we think consumers are going to want to be able to just generate 3D worlds, you know, on the fly? In the same way that do they really want to generate video kind of on the fly seems to be a really big question to me. And I know, you know, for example, Grok just announced their video generation feature and they're selling it as, oh, this is the new Vine, right? Like, if you like video, short-form video, social media, this is it, but on demand. I guess, Chris, question to you is just like, do you think ultimately this kind of tech is like, it's like an enterprise thing? It's like for professionals that are designing movie and game experiences? Or do you really envision a world where this is like consumer? Like you log onto your computer and like, I'm going to just type in the game that I want to play and the computer generates it?
I think this is so transformational that Google should change their company name immediately to jump on this trend. That's what I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Happen.
Maybe some kind of metaverse, meta.
I don't know. I actually do think this is really important, right? Which is that I think 3D is the natural next space for AI models because you're going to want to interact with things. And as you're imagining new things, you can start to say, okay, I'm going to want my code to run over here. Or maybe you're an architect, you want to design your building, you want to see how it looks. Maybe you're designing your kitchen. You want to bring those models straight in and imagine how it's going to look and here's the placement there. So I think there is an enterprise case for this. I think there's a consumer case. Actually, just hanging out, I want some chill vibes, etc. I want to customize this space for me, play some music, AI generated, of course. And then I think just immerse yourself in these spaces. So I really do believe that reality is here. And again, even simple things like this podcast, the four of us are, you know, 2D spaces. We could be in the same space together, interacting with each other and throwing things and all that sort of thing. So I do think 3D is the space that is going to become super important. I guess with Veo 3, the demos looked incredible. What wasn't clear to me was how real time that was. I don't know if that video was sped up or not. So That would be one thing. The probably the other thing is I imagine that the amount of compute used to generate those scenes is probably, you know, heating up small countries as we speak. So I think that's probably going to be the kind of blocker there. But, you know, it's very early in this technology, and I imagine that it's... you know, it's going to improve in time and it's going to get faster and it's going to be cheaper to run in the same way as LLMs have done the same over time. So I'm excited about this. This is really where I think the world is going to go. And I think it's going to lead to the personifications of our AI helpers and all that sort of thing. This is where I want to be.
You know, think about today in the enterprise, the world of training. You know, how many employees are happy about the training programs they have to attend in videos or the onboarding experience or even internal communication, right? If you're in sales and you want to communicate and pump up your sales team, this is going to open a whole type of new world, I think, that we haven't seen just yet. So it's really a big deal, I think, in how we consume, but how we influence and get people an experience that is very different from what they've gotten in the 2D kind of model that we're in today.
Katra, I did want to kind of pick up on this question of cost. You know, so I saw the demo and immediately was messaging my friend being like, oh, imagine this future world where you like subscribe and it's a massively multiplayer online world, but it's infinite. You can go in any direction, right? Because the computer just keeps generating more world for you to explore. And we're like, oh, that'd be incredible. And then my friend was like, well, you know, the problem is it's going to cost you $1,000 a month. It's going to cost you $2,000 a month because like the amount of compute you need to generate this at any level of, you know, eye-popping detail is like still very, very expensive. And so I guess I have a question for you on just like how quickly you think the costs will come down. But it's kind of relevant to whether or not this will become a consumer thing or really even becomes a thing where, you know, Chris, you're almost like casually like, oh, I just want a virtual environment for a meeting that we're going to have. You know, that kind of implies a sort of cost of producing these things, which is way cheaper than where we are right now. Do you think those costs will come down quickly, or is it you know, actually a pretty hard problem from here to mass distribution at a pretty inexpensive cost?
Yeah, I think, I mean, just with the regular generative AI, we're already right now, you know, kind of struggling with the cost, you know, of inference and the inference scaling. So there's a lot of effort, you know, to reduce that cost for generative AI because, you know, even inferencing right now with the, you know, the token generation and so on, the sequential nature of that. So it is a tough problem to solve. And, you know, how long is it going to take for that cost to be to go down? I think it might take some time. I don't know if quantum, you know, technology can help, you know, with some of these things to accelerate some of these simulations and, you know, quantum machine learning. That would be really cool, you know, once we get to the quantum advantages and the useful quantum. Yeah, I don't know exactly how long. You know, I think there might be maybe some breakthroughs in hardware and memory technologies and so on, and the bandwidth that we're facing right now with generative AI. But for sure, this is very exciting. I think it's the glimpse, a glimpse of the future of content generation where anyone can become a game designer, a word builder with a simple text prompt. And of course, if done right, done cheaply, I can see this becoming both huge in both the consumer space and the enterprise space.
Yeah, I love this comment about like, well, we may need quantum to get this to work. You know, it's almost like with AI, it's like, we've created this like machine god, and we're like, well, we really need you to generate recipes for, you know, cooking, you know, dinner. And it's a little bit like, well, in order to get these video games to work, we really need quantum. It's like these massive, massive technological leaps to achieve, I think, which is something very everyday, which I think is very important in its own way. Let's move to the next topic. This is actually following in some ways on the theme that we've been talking a little bit about. I think the way to introduce this is to say, I love Claude Code. One of my favorite sort of technologies of this era has been Claude Code. And Claude Code has turns out to have these power users who are running Claude Code agents 24/7, 365, many instances all at the same time. And this really kind of fascinating policy change took place where Anthropic basically came out and said, look, if you're on Pro, you're on our max plan, our $200 a month plan, what we're going to do is we're going to implement some rate limits. You can only actually get a certain amount of access to our models, a certain amount of access to Claude Code, a certain amount of access to our base models. And this also obviously created a little bit of a clamor. But I think the main thing I really want to talk about, which I think is like a really fun discussion, is, you know, I know when $200 a month plans hit the market, people were like, this is crazy. Who's going to spend this kind of money on not one, but multiple services at this rate? You know, people then said, okay, well, the reason you do that is because you have to pay for the cost of all this infrastructure. It actually turns out to be really expensive if it's not VC subsidized. How I kind of read this rate limiting is even once you raise the price to $200, it's still really hard to make this sustainable because of how much people use AI. Is this sustainable? Like, what's the real cost that we eventually will need to pay for the dollars and cents to work out on these proprietary models?
I think there's a few things here. I think, first of all, like, we have all used code from Claude. It's terrific. I think it's kind of like victim of their own success to some extent, right? I mean, if you look at, there's two stats here I think they shared, is that, you know, they've had 7 outages. So I think clearly this is kind of being victim of your own success. And this new, I think, rate limiting model here is only going to affect 5% of people. So in fact, most people won't even see it. If I look at my own usage and the usage of my customers, it is a challenge because, you know, it's so good. You just use it all the time. And I think the cost of per token is what, $9. And so if you now do the math, it's really going to be difficult for these models. The better they get into, you know, giving you the answer, how they're going to be able to monetize this. And so I think we're getting to that level. It's like they're trying to figure out where the monetization is. There's clearly pressure for getting there. I mean, I like what you said earlier, is like, you know, will you be able to figure out through optimization, through hardware? I think, you know, we've seen this before, you know, in the analytics world. I did a startup that had something called adaptive caching. I'm waiting to see when we're going to have token caching and when we're going to start seeing ways that we can use software to optimize the interface between the query, the request, and the infrastructure cost of it. And so I guess that's what's probably going to happen next for these models.
Yeah, totally. I mean, what you're describing is, I think, a really super interesting, and Couch, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on this, is like, it's almost like a race against time, right? What I mean by that is either you all of us on a call are paying $4,000 a month for a subscription, or they figure out a way to optimize it to keep the cost sustainably lower, right? And by sustainably lower, we might mean $200 plus still. Kaltar, is that kind of the world, like, who's are we going to win that race, or are we going to end up in a world where it's like, yeah, you do just got to pay $4,000 a month for this?
No, I think it's going to be an ongoing optimization thing.
They
have to, you know, that, of course, you know, these companies that have all these massive infrastructures, so they're continuously trying also to reduce their costs. And of course, they reduce that, that's going to reflect also on their prices. So what Anthropic did, I think, was necessary and inevitable, because, you know, it just shows the sign of the maturation of the AI markets, because the drama, you know, around this rate limiting, I think it's a bit overblown, because it's a simple matter of economics. You know, these AI models, they're incredibly expensive to run, and the small number of super users can make these fixed price, you know, subscriptions unprofitable. So it's like the end of this free lunch. You know, the early days of generative AI, you know, they were characterized by let's have a land grab, you know, for the users, where companies are offering, you know, generous free tiers, etc., you know, to really grab the user base. But now that the market is more established, companies are really focusing on profitability here. And so it means more restrictions, more tiers, and clear connections between the price and the usage. So I think this market for pro users, where the $200 price, you know, is creating basically clear distinction between, you know, this casual and professional users. And it's not just more about usage, but also access to these more powerful models, new features, better support, etc. And that comes with a price. So, but of course, you know, it's going to be an ongoing race. How do we optimize these models? Like Bruno mentioned, you know, the caching of the tokens. There is, you know, all of these techniques that we're also leveraging in research, you know, to figure out how do you basically do, you know, the KV cache optimizations and the token optimizations and all of these things together, you know, in VLLM and other infrastructures. So that's going to be really important to continue to advance, to be able to lower the cost at, you know, whatever it takes.
I want to talk a little bit about sort of what this implies, not on the kind of provider side. We've been talking about a lot of infrastructure, cost, benefit, profits. Chris, do you want to talk a little bit about what this implies about usage? Like, it's a little bit crazy to me, because what Anthropic is suggesting is that there are people who are running just a truly mind-boggling number of coding agents to the point where it's kind of breaking their bank. Is that the right way of reading it? Like, I don't know if your experience with Claude Code is similar, where you're spinning up, you know, 100 instances to run 24/7 for you.
No, I'm on the $80 plan for Claude Code, and I was thinking about the $200 plan, and, you know, if I thought I could have done that, I would have done that. I would have run my agents in the background all of the time. So now I'm not going to upgrade to the $200 plan, because I already have stress with Claude. I've got the $200 on ChatGPT, but I refuse to bring that down just in case GPT-5 comes anytime soon. So I'm just stressed all of the time. So I hit the Claude rate limits all of the time today. In fact, I know what's going to happen on a $200 plan. It's going to go like this. It's going to be like, oh, I was using Opus to answer this question, but I really feel that Sonnet could answer this question. So I'm going to give it to Sonnet. And then you'll be like, oh, I'm just creating unit tests. No, I'll give that across to ChatGPT. It can do the unit test. I'm not going to burn my tokens on Claude with that one. And you're going to start to really think about which model you're using for which use case, et cetera, et cetera. And then you're going to automate that within Claude Code and say, okay, no, I want this routed over here. I want this over here. You know, it's going to be crazy town. That's the world I live in already. So I'm now just jealous that I could have been running agents in the background 24/7.
You missed this golden window of opportunity where people were literally just taking money out of you know,
yeah.
Dario's pocket, basically.
That could have been me.
That could have been me. You could have been a big star, Chris.
Isn't that good, though? Yeah. I mean, I just want to double-click on what Chris just said. Shouldn't we be thinking about optimization and not wasting resources? Like, it's almost kind of, it feels to me like exchange in value, right? So if I'm going to pay $80, I don't want to waste that, right? And I know somebody else is paying for it, but at some point, I think about it a lot for enterprise customers is that they're trying to hit that line of like, am I getting more value than what I'm paying for? And I think Claude is and Anthropic is trying to figure out where is that bend, right? Where's the ceiling? Where's the floor?
But I would say this
I'm paying for artificial intelligence. I don't want to be thinking. That's the AI's joke. You know, it's AI's
joke. Well, I mean, yeah, also this is like, I mean, it's worth mentioning because, and Kalsar, I'll let you in, is like, the original vision was intelligence too cheap to meter, right? Like that was the Sam Altman, you know, slogan. We're like in a world right now, which is like, looks very different from that. But sorry, Kalsar.
Yeah, I think this, the optimizations, and of course, you know, the end users don't need to think about these things, but the companies, you know, delivering these platforms, that's really crucial. So, you know, these cost optimizations, it's, I think, a multi-front battleground. Things like KV cache management through reuse, compression, quantization, pruning, speculative decoding, disaggregating storage, lots of techniques are being, you know, these are like a top-tier weapon here. And, you know, how do you combine that with batching and compiled execution and, you know, tiered routing and all of that? There's a lot of techniques here. And it's not an easy, you know, thing, because with generative AI, you have, you know, this pre-fill and decoding, which add complexity, additional complexity, especially as the context lengths, you know, keep increasing. So I think the winners here will deliver, you know, scalable and fast and affordable AI at real world volume. So, and I think it's still, you know, a competition ongoing, you know, that these companies delivering these services need to figure out.
And you don't even have to think about a difficult use case like code. Like, just think about the use case of searching. I think I read in The Economist, the cost of searching using an OpenAI or Claude is 7 times more than searching on Google. So there's a real impact, like in using the tool poorly. And so I think it's a good thing that we're all thinking about, you know, what's the value versus the cost here and what's the best use case for the tool?
I don't know, because I get my information back from OpenAI and Claude with the answer to my question. Whereas I'm maybe, in order to find out the thing I want to find out on Google, I may be clicking on 50 different links and seeing adverts for,
Let me convince you to use AI mode.
Yeah.
Have you used AI mode? Now I'm selling you Google's platform.
AI mode, but
use AI mode more.
There is a clue in the title, AI mode, which is, guess what's running behind there? GPUs
it's
and stuff,
very
right?
Good.
So the
it's
same thing's
good.
Happening.
It's very good.
All right. I'm going to move us on before we get into a protracted battle about AI mode, which we should talk about at some point, but is not on the agenda for today's MOE. All right, I'm going to move us on to our final topic. There's this joke that I feel like is circulating around the AI space where, you know, every time someone wants to make a big proclamation around AI, they publish a single serving website that has their essay on it. And finally, I think after every other major figure in AI has done this, Zuck is finally out with his. So he released an essay called Personal Superintelligence, short essay. And in many ways, it is sort of like Meta's vision of where all this technology is going. And I do want to kind of just like read a quick paragraph to kind of set the scene a little bit, though I think the whole thing is worth reading. So Zuck writes, quote, "As profound as the abundance produced by AI may one day be, an even more meaningful impact on our lives will likely come from everyone having a personal superintelligence that helps you achieve your goals, create what you want to see in the world, experience any adventure, be a better friend to those you care about, and grow to become the person you aspire to be." And I kind of wanted to bring this one up just because obviously Zuck is a major voice. They've been on a tear recently building their superintelligence lab. We talked about Scale just a few weeks ago. And so, Bruno, maybe I'll kick it to you. Is I think the question I want us to start with is, everybody wants to do superintelligence, but it kind of feels like everybody, well, and you're going to have to explain what you're doing in just a second, but that like it seems like there's many different visions of superintelligence emerging. And I do want to just spend some time to just talk about like what are the differences that were emerging between what OpenAI is trying to achieve, what Meta is trying to achieve, what Anthropic's trying to achieve. They really seem like different visions of superintelligence, but Bruno, I'll let you explain your very kicking shades, and then I'll let you respond to the question.
I think you're right. I think there's multiple ways to think about it. I'm wearing the Mitig glasses, which I love because they are giving me a different interface than my phone. And I think there's no doubt that in the future, this will become obsolete in the way we interface with data and in the rest of the world. There are some issues around privacy, I think, to solve for this. You know, I mean, you can real-time post online and people might not like that. I think it collects about 32 out of 35 possible data types and data points. And so this is super powerful in comparison to what you had. And so I definitely kind of like where he's going in terms of, you know, if you think about OpenAI, right? OpenAI is, I think, approach is telling us is about productivity and power in a way. Anthropic, I think, is on to this, the safety first, you know, topic, which we need to talk about, governance, safety, attribution of content. And I think, you know, what Meta is after is, you know, how do you give people superpower? And I definitely think that, you know, sometimes we think about this Gen AI trend as the wrong way to think about it, right? We think about simple use cases like searching or maybe doing something better than Google, but there's so much more, right? I look in the way, for instance, I consume and understand content much, much better. I might actually be slower, but I'm actually be better. Like I talked about Notebook LM earlier. Notebook LM gives me a mind map. It gives me a podcast. It gives me a synthesis of a paper that I might not read, but I might end up understanding better because I have a different interface. So definitely this idea of using Gen AI as the Iron Man suit for us as humans to make us more useful is that I like the way to think about it versus the rest of the narrative that you see in the industry, which is about, you know, a conflict between the human and the machine, which I don't believe in.
Yeah, for sure. And I think actually, I mean, you bringing up the sunglasses, I think is pretty interesting because I think, Chris, another way of looking at this is there's these essays, but we can also think a little bit about like what are the next gen technologies these companies are demoing. And it is kind of interesting to me that like Meta's like, we've got the sunglasses. That'll be the form factor for maybe AI in the future. You know, there's the Jony Ive thing. We've already mentioned him, so maybe worth returning to that is like they were talking about like, oh, it's going to be like this, like, device with no screen, right, is going to be like the sort of future. I guess among all these visions, is there one that kind of like really sticks out to you as someone who's like very deep in the space?
I think they all have their place. I really do think they all have their place, right? Whether you're sticking something in your brain, whether you're sticking something in your glasses, whether you're sticking something around your neck, or, you know, or whether you're, you know, just interacting with your phone, or I think all of these things have a place. I think we'll know when we know. I hate that answer in that sense, but I think we know when we know. And I do think the glasses probably has a big thing. We're all used to wearing glasses anyway, or some of us are. I think this enhancement as you go around and, you know, have a look at something, etc. I think that's going to make a lot of sense. I don't think the phone's going away, though, because I think you're still going to pick up and read things. I just think we're going to be in a multi-device world, and we're all going to be spending a load of money. I do like the robotic
the future. The subscription cost is $2,000 a month. So.
Yeah, everything's $200 a month. You know, and if I get a $200 a month robot, I'm going to be sending that thing running around. Right, all at a time. It's like, you run, robot. I want my money. You go to the shop and get me this. You get me that. My glasses, I'm going to wear all the time. I have, by the way, I have a pair of those glasses, Bruno, and I put it on, and I do conference calls with them, and it's really nice in the summer. You wander around at a conference
call. It's pretty
good. But people think you're nuts. They think you're speaking to yourself. People give me money in the street because they think I'm a nutter. So you've monetized
the use of your Meta glasses is basically.
Yeah,
I'm
gonna
take a cultural,
you know,
shift, Chris. People maybe want more. People use it.
Yeah,
maybe, but I think if somebody saw you like using your phone, I don't know, hundreds of years ago, they would think you're nuts.
Yeah, but I think we're even more nuts because now we're not even going to be speaking to people. You're going to be like, I'm speaking to my AI. And they're like, oh, yeah, your AI. Okay.
That's nice.
Okay.
But don't you run into this already? I mean, I don't have hair. So when I wear those, people see I'm on the phone. But if I had long hair, you could imagine that I'm talking to myself. So I think we've crossed that already. I'll give you one use case that I think will be very useful. My mother is French, right? So I'm French. And my mother-in-law is American. Neither of them speak the same language. I would love to have subtitles here so that they can talk to each other and understand. That's where I think a use case like the glass, it's super helpful, right? And I agree with you, Chris. Like I do phone calls. I wouldn't listen to music with it because it's just not the quality that I want. But it's great every once in a while to be on the phone call and not having to put something in your ear.
Podcasts are really good for this.
Yeah.
Plug. If you want to listen to Mixture of Experts, put on your Meta glasses and listen through your temples.
Kathar, maybe I'll turn to you to give you sort of the last word here. I think in the past, when we've talked about the superintelligence topic, you've tended to be a little bit more skeptical on all things superintelligence. But I feel like it's a good time to be like, especially with all the announcements this week, are you feeling the AGI? Like, do you feel like we're on a superintelligence path? Or do you still think that essays like this are maybe, you're a little skeptical? It's mostly marketing.
Of course, I still have some skepticism here. Some of it, you know, seems to me it's like marketing because, you know, this is a rebranding of the existing ideas and the way to distract from Meta's other challenges. So there is some truth to this. You know, superintelligence is a buzzy term and the essay, you know, is light on concrete details. However, it does provide a clear and compelling vision, like, you know, I think everybody here said. It's a nice vision. It's distinct from what we're hearing from other major players, you know, so it's really fascinating to see how this vision evolves as the technology mature. But one thing here, the hardware here is key. So this vision of a personal superintelligence is basically linked to Meta's hardware ambitions. So if AR glasses become the next major computing platform, Meta, of course, will be in a prime position to own what we call the operating system of personal AI. So who's going to win that battle? What devices? Of course, we're going to be surrounded by all kinds of devices. Like Chris said, maybe something in your brain, something around your neck, something in your hand, something or a robot walking with you. So who's going to own that? Or are we just going to be like a hybrid world where you have multiple OSs or personal, you know, AI computers or devices that are running around and everybody prefers certain devices versus others? So it's going to be an interesting play to see and how these things all evolve. Are we going to converge into one single platform? Like the phone, sometimes I feel it's one unifying platform. We're all using it. But are we getting into a world where it's a multitude of devices, pretty diverse, fit per person? Or we're still going to see some convergence? So it's going to be an interesting thing to see.
Totally, yeah. The idea of like multi-layered personal superintelligence is both interesting and also very funny. It's kind of like the idea, like in the future, I have a hyper-intelligent sunglasses. At the same time, I have a hyper-intelligent watch and a hyper-intelligent phone, and they all come from different companies, right? And like there will actually be this very funny period where, I don't know, maybe my like Apple Watch is like, those glasses always get it wrong. Yeah, they're trying to like undermine one another.
Even something you could design yourself using AI, like a device that you design, that you can wear, that you can, you know, who knows? It could be like super personalized. That's all, you know, generated by AI in a virtual 3D world. So it's going to be interesting.
Well, this is great. It's all the time that we have for today. Kathar, Chris, good as always to have you on the show. And Bruno, hopefully we'll have you back sometime here on MOE. Thanks to all you listeners for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.